and generals who got medals they didn't deserve, colonels who used 22-year-olds' experience to develop plans they couldn't or wouldn't work out themselves, be nickeled and dimed to death in a stupid, pointless war that no one at home seemed to care about. I'd trained my units like crazy to make sure my boys did not suffer the same fate, and succeeded so well that from my first four-month line period with Fighter, where we'd taken an average of one casualty a day, in the second period we had just two KIA and 15 wounded, even as both incoming and enemy attacks were four or five times as intense. The ratio should have been about 20 dead and 400 WIA. I was proud of that too, but obviously it didn't mean a thing to anyone but me, my troops, their parents, and Joe Cleland. The Army, my parent, and my one real teacher, was now ready to boot me out for being streetwise and school dumb. It was all too painful to be real and somehow very hard to understand. I didn't make a decision about my future that night. I turned my thoughts to Fighter, which I was anxious to get back to in the morning. My unit made sense to me at least, and finally I fell asleep, just a tired old man who'd been king for a day. If I had to leave my company and go home, and Mansfield kept insisting I did, I didn't want to leave Fighter with anyone but the best. It became a running argument between the colonel and me. He kept suggesting people, and I kept telling him they were wimps. I wanted Lieutenant Alexander, who'd proved himself to be not only a stud, but the kind of guy who'd lead Fighter with the same spirit I had. The thing was, when you're with a unit for a long time, it becomes a raging love affair. Fighter and I belonged together, and the hand-and-glove factor could be seen in the faces and manner of all the troops. They weren't exactly carbon copies of their old men, but they'd developed a certain style, I guess it could be called, for me. It was only natural. Since I was a little kid, I'd always latched on to someone I respected, an Al Hewitt or a Steve Prazenka, and knocked off anything I liked about him to make my own. It was the same in the Army, my adopting Colonel Mansfield's pistol-packing procedure, for example. If a trooper likes his CO and the CO wears his hat at a bit of an angle, the trooper starts wearing his hat like that, too. If the CO acts cocky, confident, and sure of himself, so do the boys. It's kind of like tailor-making your own coat. You steal the best-designed sleeves, pockets, buttons, and lapels you see, and one by one put them on until you've got the perfect coat, which, just by wearing it, you grow into it until it fits and becomes uniquely yours. I wanted Alex to replace me because we were cut from the same bolt of cloth. What I liked about him was he was a brave, no-nonsense man who was never actually insubordinate, but close. Nothing was worth taking seriously, according to Alexander. As a result, he was a calm, cool platoon leader who looked after his troops, and they loved him for it, at the same time leaving lots of room for showmanship. I'd never forgot the night an enemy force got itself behind Alex's patrol, and I couldn't raise him on the radio to tell him. About the time I knew he'd be saddling up to come home, I got artillery and flares peppering in all over his planned return route, which was where the North Koreans were laid up. It was kind of dangerous, but I figured Alex would come up on the radio and tell us to shut it off, and I could tell him about the enemy and an alternate return route. He didn't. In desperation, just when I knew he had only enough time to make it back to our lines before light, I stood on top of a frontline bunker and yelled at the top of my lungs into the dead quiet valley below. "Alex, this is Hack. Come back through the first platoon. Don't go as planned. Come back through first platoon." A moment later, a voice bellowed up from the dark valley floor. "Okay, Hack," he replied. "First platoon." "Let me tell you about my platoon leader," Alex's legend might have begun. "He's not afraid of anything. He stands right in the middle of no man's land and yells right up the enemy's nose." He told me when he got back safe and sound that his radio had gone out. He'd assumed, with all the friendly fire and all the light, that something wasn't right, and had already decided to come back a different route. No sweat. So I wanted Alexander. Mansfield refused. He didn't like Alex. He told me he was a wise ass, which was true, but all my guys were wise asses. Cocky wise asses, in fact, because that's what I wanted them to be. You've got to be pretty confident to spend your days as a moving target. The next thing I knew, Mansfield decided to send one of his staff captains to take over fighter. I hit the roof. I'd known the guy in Trieste. He was worthless as a troop commander, and I didn't want him having anything to do with my unit. Mansfield and I got into a very big argument, and as usual, when I lost my temper, I said a lot of things I shouldn't have said. In the end, I lost anyway. The staff captain came up to take command of the company, and I went down to battalion staff until I got my orders to go home. Less than a week later, I stood outside the battalion CP with Colonel Mansfield, watching my old company being savaged. The hilltop home of Fighters CP and Brinkley's Bakery had become an inferno. Staring up in the dark, it looked to us as though they'd been overrun, but there was no way to find out. Fighter was silent, with no one up there manning the radio or switchboard. I was getting more anxious by the second. The colonel was worried, too, so when I suggested I go up and find out what was going on, he gave me the green light and I was off, radio operator in tow. We ran straight up the hill through Easy's trenches. It was a quick trip, mainly because hardly anyone bothered to challenge us. When I hit fighter, the first thing I heard was, "Halt!" Just one of the guys doing as he'd been taught. "Hackworth!" I yelled and kept running. "Halt! Hackworth! Halt! Hackworth!" "Shit, sir, it's great to hear you," I heard again and again as I moved through the trench. All I wanted to know was what the hell was happening. No one had any idea. All they knew was they got hit bad. No artillery went out. No one could raise the CP on the phone, and it looked as if the penetration had been right up the center of the company sector. I bumped into Alex, who'd taken command by default. He'd sealed the penetration and was now cleaning up the gooks on the reverse slope. When everything was under control, I ran down to the company CP. Inside, all was quiet. The commo sergeant was dead, blown up by a grenade. The inner door between the commo shack and the CO bunker was closed. I kicked it open. There, sitting on the little chair that used to be mine, was the new captain, head down between his legs, crying. I walked up to him and belted him in the mouth. I got on the horn to battalion. I told Mansfield the situation, and that I'd assumed command from this babbling son of a bitch, and I told him he damn well better give fighter to Alex, whose platoon had just saved the whole unit moments before. Now he agreed. I went out to the OP in front of 2nd Platoon. It was just getting light, and in about 15 minutes it would be a very uncool place to be. But I wanted to have a last look. I wanted to figure out for myself how it had happened. How, after all the months of combat, all the knowledge, the love, the hard work all of us had put into it, I had come to receive as my farewell present the vision of my company being overrun. Fighter's men were cleaning up the battlefield, evacuating our dead and wounded. An occasional enemy mortar round came crunching in. The sights and sound of death were all around me, yet I was not there. I was somehow removed. As if I were watching from a great distance, a surreal, dumb show not intended for an audience. For almost 3 years, I'd seen, heard, and smelled death among my friends and among my men. But as I hovered over fighter in my mind's eye, I knew that never before had I felt death so strongly as I did now. It was a dull horror that spread from my gut to my heart, to my limbs, and to my head. And I knew that the fate of fighter was no longer in my hands, any more than George or Easy or the Raiders would ever be again. It was time to go home. 10. Black Shoes. They called it the Brown Shoe Army, and then it was the Black Shoe Army. It's funny how the little things changed everything somehow. What made it different? I don't know what the hell it was. You're still the same guy, still the same son of a bitch you ever were, still good or still bad, but that changing of the shoes really put something in the air. Captain Steve Prezenka, U.S. Army, retired. Intelligence and Reconnaissance Platoon Sergeant, Trieste United States Troops, Trust, 1947 through 50. "Where'd you get all those medals, Captain?" The voice, close behind me, dripped with sarcasm. "You buy 'em in the PX?" I turned around, only to be confronted by two MPs with big grins and hard eyes. They looked strangely out of place in the St. Francis Hotel bar. "Looks to me like you're impersonating an officer, boy," said the other one, putting his hand on my elbow and easing me to my feet. "I think we should step outside." He'd gotten my number, all right. As far as I was concerned, I'd been impersonating an officer since the second I was commissioned, but I didn't like the way he said it, and I didn't like that arrogant son of a bitch touching me. I'd just gotten home, assigned to Fort Mason for processing. I'd spent the last couple of days wandering around San Francisco, the other end of the earth, it seemed, from the trenches of Korea, trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. It was the toughest decision I'd ever faced, and I only had 3 days to make up my mind. The only two options, according to the personnel officer at Mason, were to sign up for another 3 years as a reserve officer or to get out of the Army. It shouldn't have been so hard. General Cleland had pretty well convinced me to get out and go to school, but I'd rotated home with Roy Hurt, that G-223rd West Point stud of a platoon leader whose father was a colonel, and he'd spent the whole damn boat ride persuading me to stay in. Now, as the MPs led me out of the bar, all I knew for certain was that a purple rage was washing over me. I was embarrassed. The other patrons, who hadn't even glanced in my direction when I'd arrived, let alone come over to slap me on the back or say, "Job well done," were now gawking, and I could see on their faces their collective disdain for just another Army guy in trouble. So much for the glory of being a soldier, I thought, as the MPs hassled me, now in the hotel lobby, for identification I didn't have. I finally convinced them to call Fort Mason, and as one of them marched off to the phone booth, the other stayed and kept an eye on me. In the meantime, I thought about the Army, to keep myself from punching out my smart-assed captor. There was no question but that it was my life, or at least it had been for 7 years now. I'd been a private, I'd been a non-com, I'd jumped into Korea eyes wide open, and suddenly I was an officer. A little leap that had cost me, on paper anyway, 3 more years' service. I'd gone back to Korea not just because I couldn't handle the idea of stateside duty, but because of the sergeant combat complex that had fueled me since Trieste. I'd been determined to get as much combat experience as possible, so that no one could ever put me down again for not being the most qualified at my job. It seemed to me that was a career choice in itself. But now the war was almost over, and combat qualifications would have nothing to do with anything. Reserve officers would be getting the axe en masse, according to General Cleland, and even if I signed up, there was no guarantee that I wouldn't be chopped within months. It seemed so unfair, particularly since I still had almost a year to go on my 3-year wartime officer's contract, but I guessed it had always been that way. The reserve men were called in to do the platoon and company level dirty work while so many regulars hid under staff duty rocks. When the shooting was over, the regulars pranced out into the sunlight and ruthlessly ground the fighters into the dirt. I saw the MP who'd called Fort Mason striding across the hotel foyer, a sheepish look on his face. Guess someone had told him I was indeed Boy Captain Hackworth, and that the medals were well earned and all mine. "Sorry about that, Captain," he said. "Gee, Captain," the other jumped in. "No hard feelings, huh?" For a moment, I just looked at the two polished MP pricks sniveling in front of me. For some reason, they said it all, whatever it was, and in that instant, I made up my mind. "Just get fucked," I said. "I'm getting out of your Army anyway." I was off active duty service for 2 years, the longest of my life. I'd never know whether I made the right decision in quitting over the MPs. One thing I was sure of, though, was that I regretted it from the moment I left Fort Mason. Civilian life was boring. It just wasn't my bag. From the outset, I missed the adventure, the kinship, and the sense of belonging that came with being in the Army. I probably missed the structured, disciplined life, too. I couldn't find a purpose in the world outside the military, and the same unknown variable that had compelled me from childhood to join up now had me counting the days until my self-imposed exile was over. General Cleland had been assigned the top soldier job in the Army, SCG 18th Airborne Corps. We corresponded frequently. He urged me not only to hit the books, but to remain active in the reserves so I wouldn't lose touch. Accordingly, I joined, or more precisely rejoined, the 40th Division, which was transferred back to California and National Guard ineptitude when the Korean War ended 6 weeks after I came home. It didn't take long for me to realize why the 40th had been so screwed up when it first deployed to Korea. There was nothing military about this NG organization, except that we wore uniforms when we met once a week to drink coffee and shoot the breeze. Each summer, we had a 2-week training period at Camp Roberts, but by the time we'd unpacked and got set to play war, it was just about the time to go home. Without General Cleland to fuel the flame, the light of the fireball had flickered and died. For myself, I started out as an enthusiastic troop CO in the Division Recon Squadron, but when I found I was one of the few guys on the block who even gave a damn, I decided not to make waves. Instead, I rocked along with the rest of the weekend warriors and refused to feel guilty over the absolute waste of taxpayer dollars. I was at loose ends. It was a post-combat hangover for which no hair-of-the-dog cure existed, made all the worse by newspaper and magazine coverage of the unsatisfying conclusion of the war. The Time magazine wrap-up, for example, which contained an excerpt from a wartime interview with General Van Fleet, damn near killed me. Reporter: General, what is our goal? Van Fleet: I don't know. The answer must come from higher authority. Reporter: How may we know, General, when and if we achieve victory? Van Fleet: I don't know, except that somebody higher up will have to tell us. What, I asked myself, is a war without a goal? What was victory if not something you could taste and breathe and feel? Instead, there'd just been 3 years of fighting, for nothing. $22 billion spent, and no decisive victory. More than 33,600 American lives lost, 103,000 men wounded in action, 13,000 men captured or MIA. And that was not to mention the ROC civilian military casualties of almost 844,000, and the 3.7 million left homeless in South Korea alone. It was such a horrible waste, and Secretary of State John Foster Dulles's War's End proclamation that, for the first time in history, an international organization has stood against an aggressor, did little to justify it, at least in my eyes. We hadn't lost, but we hadn't won. Even worse, we, meaning not the guys on the ground, but the UN governments led by the United States, hadn't even tried, at least after the first year. It was something I didn't think I'd ever understand. I settled in Santa Monica, dutifully enrolled in Santa Monica City College, and began to educate myself. It meant nothing to me. I just managed to scrape by. I felt bitter, hurt, betrayed. Most of my energy was spent drinking, fighting, and chasing pussy, till finally I reached the point where I gave up the first for about a year to stop the second. But that's where I drew the line. When my grandmother, who still lived right down the road in Ocean Park, died in 1954, I was surprised at how deeply it affected me. She'd been a bigoted, opinionated old lady. So many of the 1860s values she'd stamped into my impressionable child's mind had been proved inaccurate in the years since I'd left home, but I thought I'd dismissed the little pieces of Graham herself as each of her truths bit the dust. But I hadn't. She was as much a part of me as I was of her, and at 23 I realized that that was never going to change. Graham was a brave frontier lady whose family had traveled overland from Virginia to Kentucky to the rich mining country of Colorado with the dream of carving out a new life. Many times she'd told me about that life, how she'd hidden in her prairie house as Indians on the warpath stalked around outside, how her father, John Steadman, would load up his rifle and shoot the red men to protect his kids. In her 19th century way, Graham had had the same lust for adventure as the men of the Hackworth clan she married into, and though it was Uncle Roy who spun tales of the war to end all wars, it was Graham who drummed into me the litany of Hackworth military feats throughout America's history. Inaccurate, as most of her accounts proved to be, the constant commercial for duty, honor, and country instilled in me a fierce patriotism which guided me every day of my life. Thanks to her, I grew up believing that my family made this country, with an axe in one hand, a rifle in the other, chopping down Indians, trees, or anything else that stood in the way of progress, of manifest destiny, of what was rightfully ours. After the funeral, two of Graham's children raided her little house in Ocean Park. Years before, prior to his disappearing down a Cripple Creek mine shaft never to be seen again, John Hackworth, Graham's husband, had been a successful gold miner and mining superintendent. Now their kids, who still lived in Colorado, were convinced my grandfather had a stash of gold stock certificates concealed under her bed. Having suffered the indignity of receiving relief packages on our doorstep all through my Depression childhood, powdered milk, instant margarine, and all kinds of other stuff, including clothes and cardboard shoes for me that you could tell at 100 paces had been issued by the state, I could have told them that if Graham had anything, it was the money I'd sent her every month since I joined the Merchant Marine. But they didn't ask, and when I walked into the house, they were literally ripping it apart. My Aunt Frida was wearing a gold watch I'd bought for Graham in Italy. I tore it off her arm and told everyone to get the hell out, that I'd just come back from killing a lot of people and I was perfectly prepared to kill them, too. In his way, big, tough David Hackworth was still the same little kid who'd clung to Graham's legs as she stood by the door holding a suitcase and threatening to leave if I didn't shape up. The trick had worked for a few years until the time the suitcase popped open and I found out it was empty. Now, as then, having lost my army family, I was a brand new orphan, with nothing to fall back on. One thing I was, though, was a survivor. I transferred to Woodbury College after a year at SMCC, majored in salesmanship, and became a part-time insurance man for Prudential. Both Jack Speed and Uno Rentmeister came out to visit for a while, and get to know some of my female clients. While they whined and dined, I just kept on selling, and in 3 months, I'd sold enough insurance to qualify for the $1955 million round table. I had to admit there was great satisfaction in finding out I wouldn't be a complete bust in civilian life, but I was still counting those days because I had no intention of being a civilian even 1 minute longer than necessary. Besides, I was finding out that civilian life could be damn dangerous. According to Jack Speed, some of my beloved raiders had pulled off a final stateside raid long after the unit broke up with the help of a submachine gun one of them had managed to smuggle back from the battlefield. Apparently, when these three raiders were not appropriately welcomed in San Francisco, they decided to announce their return by raiding a downtown bank in broad daylight. The submachine gun prevented heroics on the part of the bank's staff, but the guys got caught a short time later, and were now serving 20 to 30 years in a California federal penitentiary. In mid-51, I wrote General Cleland to tell him I'd almost finished those magic 2 years of college and had submitted my application for active duty. I told him I'd requested assignment to the 82nd Airborne at Fort Bragg. Within days, a paratrooper friend of Cleland's at the Department of the Army's Office of Personnel Operations, OPO, called and tried to persuade me not to go there. He said the airborne was finished, army aviation and choppers were the new wave, and he could get me in on the ground floor at the aviation school at Fort Rucker. And that's about where I'll stay, too, I thought, having just completed 15 hours of fixed-wing lessons, only to find myself an unsure, uncoordinated, and dangerous pilot. No, I told the OPO colonel, if I was going to be in the Army, and if I could have a choice, I wanted to be in a paratroop outfit. It was a Jim Gavin-inspired dream that all the progress in the world would not keep me from fulfilling. With misgivings, the colonel agreed with my rationale and said he'd do what he could. It was a different army I returned to in December 1955. Manpower was out, missile power in. The darling of the armed forces was the Air Force, with the Eisenhower administration determined to hinge the nation's defense on strategic, intermediate, and long-range nuclear weapons, such as the USAF's developing 5,000-mile-range intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs. Military strength, which at the height of the Korean War had numbered 3.6 million, had already been reduced to 2.9, with deeper cuts in manpower expected across all services. Eisenhower's new look had already reduced the Army's force by a third, bringing its total to little more than 1 million men. Although the McCarthy era had ended ignominiously, the Red Scare was alive and kicking. The Russians were coming, said the military experts, with their own A-bombs and H-bombs to blow our cities off the map. As such, air defense, AD, was the password of the decade, with the 35% increased military budget mostly dedicated to the improvement of our continental air defense and to radar facilities in the Arctic. The Army's share of the new funding was devoted in great measure to the development and deployment of a 20 to 30 mile range AD anti-aircraft missile system known as the Nike Ajax. The AD facts of life notwithstanding, it was a rude shock when I found myself assigned not to the 82nd Airborne as requested, but to the 77th Anti-Aircraft Artillery AAA Battalion in Manhattan Beach, California. I was sure it was a mistake. I didn't know a damn thing about AD. I called Cleland's friend in OPO. The essence of his reply was, "Beggars can't be choosers." Apparently, he'd had a hell of a time recalling me, even with the Cleland influence and my combat record. He'd gone so far as to try bringing me in through the expanding chopper program against my wishes, but the results of my entrance physical were so poor, hearing loss and left arm still not 100%, that he couldn't even manage that. The OPO colonel assured me it wouldn't be more than a year or so before he got me back to infantry. In the meantime, he suggested I use this period as an opportunity to continue my education. It seemed that while I was struggling to get through 2 years of college, word was coming down from the top that only a master's degree made one a certified thinker in the new Army. I reported for temporary duty, TDY, to Fort Bliss, Texas, to be retrained in air defense. Bliss was home to the anti-aircraft and guided missile school, and, like Benning during the war years, was expanding at an incredible pace. Against a backdrop of blue skies and cacti, adobe buildings left over from the horse calves Indian fighting days served as monuments to simpler times. All around them, in various stages of construction, were new classrooms, offices, barracks, and ultramodern training facilities. Besides polo, which in old Army tradition was played every Sunday, Bliss ran like most civilian organizations, strictly 9 to 5, 5 days a week. It was my first encounter with the Gentleman's Army, a world all its own. Each day began when I woke up in my well-appointed private suite, put on my Class A's, and left my laundry by the door for the maid to pick up. After breakfast at the first-rate mess, I'd head off to class for a 9 o'clock start. The day's instruction was punctuated by lunch and a couple of coffee breaks, and exactly at 5 it was over to the plush officers' club for a few drinks. As much as to wind down, this last stop was necessary to avoid the evening rush hour. Hundreds of soldiers going home after their long day staring at the sky, waiting for the Soviet air armada to strike. There was an in-crowd, clubbish feel at Bliss, which was emulated throughout the whole air defense arm, and it didn't matter that the army had come to realize a guy could get pretty lazy sitting by his gun waiting for an enemy who never came, and had begun infusing super gung-ho infantry and field artillery people into the program. The guys in charge at Brigade, Region, and Army Air Defense Command, ARADCOM, were still mainly World War II air defense men who'd spent their lives in step with the Air Corps and that organization's minimum military ways. It didn't make for changes, and again, I was struck not only by the overall sloppiness, but by the utter lack of urgency among permanent party personnel. It was an Air Force attitude, unshakable confidence that we're here to stay. And they were, despite the fact that AAA would be phasing out all its active-duty gun units by the end of 1956 and replacing them with missiles. The new Nike Ajax units, to most, were more of the same, even if somewhat more complex. Once their training was completed, these AD guys would go right back to staring at the sky. The only difference would be they'd be part of a new club, the Nike Battalion Package, which included all key people from the CO to the lowest radar technician. For someone like me, with absolutely no background in AAA, Bliss was more often than not a nightmare. The anti-aircraft battery officers course was so hard that I would have given up my infantry colonel's standard of living and dug a foxhole every night if it would have helped unlock the mysteries of E divided by I equals R, electricity over current equals resistance, horizontal slant ranges, or super heterodynes. Still, in direct contrast to what I'd known at Benning, the quality of instruction at Bliss was of the highest caliber. The dawning missile age had no precedent in history. The Army could no longer depend on its pink-cheeked virgin lieutenants to parrot after-action reports of World War II or even Korea to teach us how to fight tomorrow's wars. Granted, many of our instructors at Bliss were young lieutenants. Some were even drafty PFCs. Most had no combat experience either, but they did have PhDs from MIT or similar institutions. These whiz kids knew their stuff and taught it in a no-nonsense professional way. Their ability was enough to make dumb shits like me want to cry. I was worried sick about flunking out and blowing my Army career just when it was starting. I made good friends with a couple guys who were in much the same boat. Tom Traynor, a World War II battlefield commission, now a fire chief in Chicago, and Bob Strina, a private eye in Palo Alto, were both members of NG units that had been converted from infantry to AAA and recalled in response to the Red Scare. The three of us lent each other moral support and spent many an evening drowning our sorrows across the border in Juarez, Mexico. For more concrete assistance in passing the damn course, I turned to two Marine Corps officers, Lieutenant Casey and Captain Everett, both longtime AD men stationed at Thousand Palms, California. We'd met through a shared passion for physical fitness. I was a fanatic about running and push-ups at this time, and because that was pretty unusual among our classmates, I guess it impressed the two gung-ho Marines, who made no bones about their feeling that the Army was a pretty Mickey Mouse organization. Marines being Marines, they no doubt didn't believe me when I told them that Fort Bliss was not really the Army. But I was desperate enough for their assistance not to stand in the door over it. In the end, I graduated 32 out of 36 in the course, but just as the guy who comes in last in medical school is still called doctor, I was still, record and MOS-wise, considered a fully qualified anti-aircraft battery officer. I took comfort in knowing that, as a commander, I would have to remember the details I'd held in my brain long enough to pass the tests. I'd just have to make sure I got some smart guys on my team to do that kind of thinking for me. Battery C of the 77th AAA was smack dab in the middle of Manhattan Beach, California. So much for the great adventures I'd dreamed of upon recall to active duty. My new Army home was half a block from my favorite beach, across the street from Poncho's, one of my favorite haunts over the last 2 years, and 10 minutes from where I was born. The post didn't have a BOQ. The departing Battery XO, a University of San Francisco basketball star named Jim Ruan, was checking out of the service, and I took over his bachelor pad on the beach. All in all, it seemed as if the only notable difference in my lifestyle was going to be wearing my soldier suit every day instead of just weekends, and, thanks to Jim, a whole new list of Southern California beauties to look up in my off hours. C Battery was one of four identical firing batteries in the 77th. It was composed of four 90mm AAA guns and two radar acquisition and tracking sections. Soldiers manned the guns, but in fact, the system pretty well ran itself. The acquisition radar was designed to pick up a target as far out as 100 miles and transfer it to the tracking radar once it got into range. The tracking radar would then send out an identification friend or foe IFF signal. If no response was received, the aircraft would be considered hostile, and we, the human element, would prepare to fire. The gun crew's tasks were simply to set the 90mm shells with an automatic fuse setter and load the guns. The tracking radar locked onto the target and did the rest. It all sounded good, but over the next 9 months, we came close to blowing friendly aircraft out of the sky on a number of occasions. There was much room for error in the system, if only because of the incredible amount of ordinary air traffic in and out of L.A. Luckily, jet fighters dispatched by the Anti-Aircraft Operations Center, AAOC, to intercept, identify, and/or shoot down the presumed hostile always saved the day, finding that the IFF equipment on board was malfunctioning or that the target was a friendly civilian aircraft that had simply lost its way. I inherited C Battery from Lieutenant David Kramer, who stayed on as my XO. Kramer was a good officer, with about 8 years' service and a lot of experience in airborne field artillery. He'd run a damn good AD outfit, a fact that, in its way, made both of our new jobs harder. No one likes to see someone come in and mess with his perfect unit, especially if that someone was as undiplomatic as I, and when I decided to shake the natural AD sit-on-your-ass mentality out of C Battery with hard training, tough inspections, and an immediate halt to those 9 to 5 days, ex-CO Kramer had no choice but to back me up. Initially, and naturally, my men hated me. Most were draftees, a number were regular lazy-ass AD-NCOs. All of them reminded me of the National Guardsmen in Company D of the 223rd, and I pushed them as hard as I had the heavy weapons company boys from the moment they stood reveille at 0600. The only people who hated me more were the Army wives, who'd gotten pretty comfortable with their husbands' 16 hours at home non-soldiering soldiers' lives, the local community, which had to bear our singing and counting as we ran down the beach every morning, and my battalion CO, Lieutenant Colonel George L. Thyssen, a weak, unsure ex-lawyer commander who knew precious little about soldiering and nothing at all about leadership. Swayed by the belly aching of some of those shrewd career NCOs who'd figured AD was a good way to mark time until I'd come in and upset their sunny California vacation, Thyssen was constantly after me to cut out the training. Air defenders, said he, did not have to be paratroopers. My stock answer was that the 6th RADCOM CG, Major General E.G. McGaw, had put out a training memo calling for an hour's PT every morning, and I was just following orders, sir. In truth, I knew the sort of training I was putting these men through was unnecessary. In AD, the odds of their needing the stamina or the infantry-like skills I insisted upon were slim to none. But, at the same time, these were line soldiers. There was no excuse for their not being kept physically tough and ready to go, regardless of the cushy jobs they had going at the moment. My concern was not without precedent. During the Battle of the Bulge in December of 44, the U.S. command flat ran out of infantrymen, and because there was no Nazi air threat, AD people were sent to fight in infantry units. The same happened in Korea. Who was to say it could not happen again? So, just like the proverbial new broom, I kept up the training, and the boys learned pretty quickly that the good old days were over, and a new man was sweeping the floor. Of course, when a new CO is a hard ass, his men look first for the chink in his armor. As a result, A leader sometimes finds himself in a situation of having to hide his more human side. One morning in the early days, for example, I had a bitch of a time running up the beach. Terrible stomach pains, so bad it took every bit of willpower I possessed to keep going. But I couldn't fall out. Not ever, let alone with the eyes of 100 unwilling air defenders boring in on me. Somehow I made it back to the battery. The doc there took one look, called for an ambulance, and before I even had a chance to protest, in the words of good Sergeant Prezenka, that only the lame, the lazy, and the screw-offs go on sick call, I was on an operating table at Fort MacArthur having my near-bursting appendix removed. I'd never know what kind of celebrations arose out of my untimely leave from C Battery, but I'm sure that was all for the best. It was the first time I'd hit sick call in almost 10 years of service. When I'd first arrived at the battery, the World War II vintage prefab facilities on post were falling apart as quickly as they'd been thrown up in the face of the imminent Red attack. The barracks were open squad rooms with no privacy. It wasn't all that easy to distinguish between the mess and the latrine. Unquestionably, something had to be done, and it was number one on my list the second I got out of the hospital. "Sir, work orders went in. Fort MacArthur just doesn't have any money," explained Master Sergeant Allison, my supply sergeant. Allison was a fine old soldier. He probably had 30 years service by then, starting out long ago as a buffalo soldier with the illustrious Black Cavalry Regiment, and I loved the guy. He drank his share of booze every day, gulping it right down, a water glass at a time, and still ran the straightest supply room I'd ever seen. "Well, Sergeant, work orders won't get this place fixed up. What do you think we should do?" Not since the 30s, when the Army was so broke that General George C. Marshall at Benning had had to mow his own lawn, had units had such a hard time making ends meet. The problem was that, for the first time in a long, long time, the man in the White House knew what was happening at Fort Huachuca or Camp Breckinridge. When the budgets hit Ike's desk, he could take one look and know that the money being requested for a radar testing station would actually be used to build a golf course or a snazzy officer's club. Eisenhower had definite ideas as to what was needed and what was not, and with a confident stroke of a pen, he axed anything that didn't fit in with his overall military austerity program. In the meantime, the troops lived in hovels and scrounged shoelaces to hold their morale up. The president was a far cry from the Ike I'd met during an inspection of my recon company nearly 10 years before in Cormones, Italy. Then, as supreme commander of all Allied forces, he'd asked me whether I was being fed well. I said no, and he'd been surprised. He immediately called over the Mediterranean Theater commander. "General Lee," he'd said to the 3-star relation of Civil War fighter Robert E. Lee, "there's a boy here who's not getting enough to eat." "No, sir," I'd interrupted. "I'm getting enough. It's just, it's always the same thing. I've been in this battalion for 3 months, and all we've had for breakfast, lunch, and dinner is dehydrated scrambled eggs and spam." "Is that true?" Ike asked General Lee. "We've had a big surplus of spam, General, and we've been trying to use it up. Well, let me check on that a little further, Ike." Before I knew it, there'd been a hushed conference of Ike's general staff right in front of me. Finally, Ike had turned to me again and flashed his famous grin. "Don't worry about it, son. We'll fix this up right away." And he did, because surplus or no surplus, we never had spam again. In 1956, a lot of units were just wearing the poverty line conditions being imposed by the new Ike. But just like that little kid in Italy who'd gotten fed up with spam, I wasn't going to. And I didn't expect C Battery to do so either. So Master Sergeant Allison started to wheel and deal for building material. The hardest thing to come by was timber. Sergeant First Class Norman Crott, an ex-Marine and damn good soldier himself, solved this problem when he let on he knew of a big stack of pine 2x4s just screaming to be liberated from a civilian construction site down the road. For the next month, we made frequent midnight hits on the site, and a number of others in the area. It wasn't exactly lawful activity, but it was good combat training for the men of my new command, who proudly started calling themselves Hackworth's Rangers. In the meantime, Gun Sergeant Charles Landry, who'd been a concrete man in civilian life, arranged to get us the excess a local concrete guy was dumping at the end of each day. The merchant got a tax break, and we got concrete walks and driveways, as well as permanent, maintenance-free revetments to replace the eroding sandbags around the guns. When we got enough wood, we rebuilt the barracks to provide individual rooms. We renovated the latrine, too. By the time PFC Richard Plumer got through tiling it with seconds from a local factory, it was, in all our opinions, the Mona Lisa of shithouses. Finally, we rebuilt and redecorated the mess to look like a fancy seafood restaurant, complete with fishnets draped all over the place, and the battery was something the men could be comfortable in and proud of. The building program had given them a break from the monotonous waiting game they'd become locked into, and combined with the training, which improved both individual and team proficiency, now the guy's drag-ass defensive attitude was being replaced with a keen offensive spirit. Anything C Battery could be the best at, it was. Best supply, best motor pool, best mess. The latter, under the watchful eye of Mess Sergeant SFC George Clark, a graduate of Tuskegee Institute with a BS in Food Administration, who could create gourmet feasts out of any Army-issue rations. We won the 47th Brigade Championship in softball and basketball, cornered the market on Brigade Soldier of the Month selection, and in the 47th's annual inspection, out of 30 batteries, ours was number one. The irony of it all was that despite our successes, I personally remained number one in both Battalion CO Thysons and the Manhattan Beach community's bad books. The concept of small posts being located in residential areas was somewhat new to the Army. It was one, I was convinced, the Manhattan Beach homeowners were none too pleased with. Though a lot of organizations came onto our renovated post for tours and went home suitably impressed, the next day I'd still get a phone call from some soroptimist or another complaining that our morning run or battery alert siren was annoying the seagulls. When I'd politely explained to the caller that it was just tough shit, she'd ring the colonel. Colonel Thysen, meanwhile, didn't even talk to me anymore. Instead, he sent reports and warning messages through his S3 or XO, or through old Milo Rowell, the hearts-losing millionaire AAA officer who'd co-located with me and Easy once upon a time in my Wolfhound days in Korea. Milo, now a captain, was assigned as the 77th Battalion's adjutant, S1. He crashed at my place until he found one of his own and kept me abreast of what the colonel was thinking. The word was never good. I demanded too much, I pushed too hard, I was insensitive to the representatives of the Seagull's Right to Nest Foundation. He was considering relieving me. The litany went on, and I was sick because I wanted the colonel to like me, and I wanted him to appreciate my unit. After all, it wasn't as though C Battery was some sad sack organization. We were damn good. And I truly believed the reason for it was the deeply ingrained trust standards of proficiency, dedication, and esprit I'd brought to the outfit. But if I'd learned soldiering in a Trieste time warp, if trust was a throwback whose standards had long since died, then it was just tough shit, Colonel Thysen, and so be it. I couldn't have changed my ways even if I'd tried. But I didn't try, because I knew my ways were right. Until a weapon disappeared. Not just any weapon, but an M2 automatic carbine. I'd been doing my monthly inventory of the armory and noticed that the bright, conscientious Mormon armorer had listed 6 weapons on guard, and I knew we only had 5 posts. When I mentioned it to the kid, he broke down and spilled all. It turned out the carbine hadn't just recently gone south. It had been missing for 3 full months, its absence undetected through 90 daily duty officer checks and 2 of my own monthly serial number inspections. It was little wonder the armorer was afraid to tell anyone. A missing carbine was FBI material, and now I couldn't either. To report it would make C, the best battery, a laughingstock, and give Colonel Thysen a damn good reason to relieve me. I told the armorer to keep it all under his hat for a few more days while I figured out what to do. Supply Sergeant Allison had a deal going with the guy who picked up the battery's garbage. It brought the trash man a bit more money, gave Allison leverage in his swapping activities, and served as preventative ass covering for me. A battery CO was responsible for all the property in his concern. As one of the last things he did before leaving a unit, he and the new CO would take a complete inventory, and whatever was missing, blankets, sheets, forks, webbing, jeeps, would have to be paid for by the departing man. The bill could run to thousands of dollars, so a savvy, reliable supply sergeant made a point of knowing what he had, what was missing, and an SOP for replacing things in time for his CO's change of command stock-taking day. The little stuff that disappeared in a unit was usually the work of unthinking troopers who just chucked things into rubbish bins. As a result, by the end of any given week, the trash man's truck was always full of GI gear, so much, in fact, that the vehicle was more like a disorganized traveling supply depot than anything else. So the deal we had was simple. Since the trash man got paid per cubic foot of stuff he collected, Allison would sign for more trash than the guy took out of the battery, and in return, the trash man would give Allison all the GI gear he found, no questions asked. So I invited the trash man for coffee. He was a Damon Runyon kind of guy, shrewd, shifty, and very sharp, and when I mentioned I was looking for an M2 carbine, he just shrugged and said he didn't come by too many of them in his truck. But, he added casually, he had one of his own, a rusty old M1 model he'd brought back from World War II. Did I want it? Did I ever? The weapon was in sorry shape, but with the help of Mess Sergeant Clark, Allison re-blued the serial-numbered receiver in the mess hall oven and replaced all the other parts. By the time they'd finished, we had what to the naked eye was a brand new M1 carbine. The M1 became a brand new M2. The later model had a selector switch that enabled it to fire fully automatic when old Allison drilled, glued, and blued a dummy switch onto the vintage carbine. He also made a new old page in his property book to square the different serial numbers, no easy chore in itself, as it required probably 10 different typewriters and pens, as well as a master forger's touch to age the paper, and finally only one step remained, to turn the weapon into ordnance, get credit for the turn-in, and remove the number from the books once and for all. I'd stayed out of the whole operation. The minute Clark and Allison, those two fine old army men, got into the act, I took the carbine off my worry list completely. So when Allison dropped by my office the day before payday, at first I didn't understand the mysterious poker face he was wearing. "Would the captain have $50? He asked. "What for, Sergeant?" "Well, Captain, I'm aiming to finish off the little project George and I've been working on." The light went on. "You got it, Allison," I said. "What have you got in mind?" "I'm thinking I'll just mosey on down to ordnance. I got a buddy over there who'd be mighty happy celebrating my win at the races, sir." Allison's plan was simple and absolutely brilliant. Traditionally, the day before the Eagle shit was one when most regular sergeants were broke and very thirsty. The supply sergeant knew his ordnance pal was no exception. So with my $50, he took his friend out on the town that night. Late in the evening, when the ordnance man was sufficiently mellow, knee-knocking drunk, in fact, Allison mentioned he wanted to do a weapons turn-in in the morning, first thing, he said, so he didn't have to waste a minute of his day off. "No problem," slurred his friend. Still feeling no pain from the night before, the next morning Allison took the weapon over to ordnance. By then, the M2 had been further modified to include a bent, no longer serviceable barrel. Within moments, the twisted rifle was on the junk heap, and a receipt had been written out. My career was saved, and Allison and his hungover buddy were off to wet their furry tongues again. For a long time, I worried where that carbine would surface, whether I'd open up the paper one morning to find a bank full of people had been gunned down on full automatic, because despite all else, I took my job in sleepy Manhattan Beach very seriously. Almost 10 years in the Army, it was my first stateside command, the first time I'd actually been tasked with the defense of the nation. Italy and Korea were both so far from home that the connection between their defense and America seemed thinner than the slack in a hair trigger. In truth, I was not as caught up as the administration and the general populace seemed to be in the fear that the Soviets were coming any second. But there was no doubt in my military mind that the communists were the enemy, and my job entailed being on alert and always ready to fight them on the beaches, in the streets, any time and any place, and beat them at all costs. Sometimes, though, it was very hard to stay enthusiastic, in my neighborhood at least. David Kramer had been transferred out of the battalion by now. He joined the Army's first nuclear-equipped division, the low-yield Honest John Packing 101st Airborne. My new XO was a fine young black lieutenant named Herb Williams, and one Sunday afternoon the two of us stopped for lunch on our way back from a meeting at Fort MacArthur. Both in uniform, we sat down in a busy San Pedro restaurant. A half hour later, without so much as a glass of water being brought to our table, the head waiter came over to tell me we might as well leave. They didn't serve coloreds there. I was ready to tear the place down. Herb himself was the one who stopped me, insisting it was no big deal. He was used to it. But at 25 years of age, I was as surprised as I'd been when I was 8 and carving Halloween pumpkins after school with my friend R. Lee Kerrigan, and Graham had dashed out of the house and told me to get that nigger off our front porch. At the time, I didn't even know the meaning of the word. Later, I chalked it up to the fact that Graham was just an old Southern lady with Civil War values. But it was 1956 now, not 1865. It was California, not the Deep South, and there was no excuse, except maybe that there were still two Americas, and to many people, only one was worth defending. I guessed America's white civilian population, most of whom had waltzed through the Korean War painlessly by turning directly to page 2 of the newspaper, had also managed to bypass the words of Kipling, which spoke most loudly for the black soldiers who served as cannon fodder in all America's wars to keep the country free. Tommy ain't a bloomin' fool. You bet that Tommy sees. C Battery continued to move from success to success. I'd weeded out most of the troublesome old air defenders. In the main, the team ran itself now. From then on, my goal in any of my commands, with senior NCOs who weren't locked into the that's-the-way-we've-always-done-it mode, and younger NCOs and smart draftee troopers whose minds and eyes were open. When we had the annual firing battery tests at Camp Irwin, I basically went along for the ride. Herb Williams, Tony Escover, radar, Warrant Officer Yoshiro Morikawa, maintenance, and my great old top, Master Sergeant Lee, ran the whole drill. We'd come a long way. The boys worked in perfect harmony with one another and their weapons systems as one by one, C Battery shot robot-controlled Soviet intruder drones out of the sky, and we came home named the best firing battery in the brigade. It was not insignificant that Colonel Thiessen did not write or call to say good job. His leadership skills wouldn't have coaxed the most eager lemming into the sea. With all the good in my unit, C Battery still had its share of losers. One of these was Private Russell, whom I caught one night trying to slip through the barbed wire fence surrounding the battery. I was duty officer that evening and had just returned from my tennis shoe-clad silent sneak-up on all the guards when I saw him in the motor pool with a blanket under his arm. "Where are you going, young soldier?" I asked. "I'm going to the beach with my girl. We're going to watch the stars." "Are you now?" I replied. "I don't think you have a pass. Do you have a pass, Russell?"
"No."
"Right. And what's that I see under your arm? Looks like that blanket is government property. Government property cannot be taken off post, can it, Russell?"
"No."
"Okay. So why don't you just march your sweet ass back to your barracks before you find yourself in more trouble?" "You don't like me," he said. The kid was absolutely right. I didn't like him at all, but it was only because I didn't like screw-ups. "You've got the potential to be a damn good soldier, Russell, if you just get off your ass and get that big chip off your shoulder." You think I have a chip on my shoulder? He retorted. Well, why don't you try to knock it off? Might be just what you need. Take off that jacket. He wanted us to be equals. Never one to let rank get in the way of a good lesson. I took off my jacket and fatigue cap and laid them on the hood of a parked Jeep. I let Russell have the first swing. I blocked it and let fly four punches that sent the private reeling to the ground. Now pick yourself up and go to bed, I told him. It was too dark to see the damage as he staggered to his feet and shagged ass to his billet. A little NCO justice never hurt anyone, I thought as I watched him go. More than once, I'd had my clock cleaned by Jesse O. Giddens, my platoon sergeant in the tank company in Italy. As far as I was concerned, getting the smartass knocked out of you was part of growing up, so I didn't give the incident another thought as I cleaned my bleeding knuckles and hit the sack. The next morning, when we moved out for our daily run, Russell was not with his platoon. Suddenly, the little incident of the night before took on awesome dimensions. NCO justice was one thing, but I was a captain and the kid's CO. In my mind's eye, I saw the private standing with a bashed-up face in front of Colonel Tyson's desk, while the good colonel rubbed his hands together with evil glee and plotted the most horrible way to relieve me. I worried throughout the run.